supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
It's a good week to be a sports fan in Philadelphia. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Aside from the NFL draft, the city's biggest running event of the year will be held at the University of Pennsylvania starting Thursday. WHYY's Tom McDonald reports.
Penn Relays director Dave Johnson says the event brings the best of the best from around the world for this 123rd running of the event, but it's more than just a track event.
It is a cultural institution of Philadelphia. It has become a part of any family's heritage, that it is a time for family reunions, for reunions of fraternities and sororities. It's a time to remember old friends, meet new ones, and reminisce about that over the course of a wonderful 3 days.
Mayor Jim Kenney says the event has been a start to many important people, not only in the track world.
Some notable participants include Philadelphia's own and NBA legend Will Chamberlain, who competed while a student at Overbrook High, second man on the moon Buzz Aldrin, music mogul Sean Combs, Democratic presidential hopefuls U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders, and civil rights leader and Westchester, PA native Bayard Rustin.
Mike Mahoney of the University of Pennsylvania, which hosts the event, says many countries use the relays as a training event for Olympic athletes.
30 gold medalists from last year's Olympic Games are Penn Relays alums. So we're looking forward to three great days on the track at Franklin Field.
About 225 colleges and more than 1,000 high schools will participate from as far away as Africa for the event. Officials pointed out there is a trail from the NFL draft that runs the Franklin Field, and they believe many will take advantage of the walk if the weather stays good to take in both events. I'm Tom McDonald, WHYY News.
Camden received a bit of positive economic news last week. The Federal Bureau of Labor Statistics finds the city and surrounding area saw a 3.5% jump in job growth this February compared to a year before. WHYY's Joe Hernandez looks at the numbers.
Camden is seeing an investment boom. We're talking hundreds of millions of dollars in just a few years. A state law passed in 2013 made it easier for New Jersey to hand out tax breaks to companies keeping or creating jobs in the Garden State, especially in struggling cities like Camden, which has seen a flood of companies promising to move in and invest.
American Water, Holtec, EMR Eastern, Subaru, Lockheed Martin. The biggest headliner may be the Philadelphia 76ers, but each of these companies have received some tax credits in return for creating new jobs.
Camden County Freeholder Director Lou Capelli says the job gains in the Camden metro area are the product of these tax breaks. Even though some of these companies are only moving within the metro area, which includes Camden, Burlington, and Gloucester counties, Rutgers University professor Stephen Danley says construction jobs may be inflating Camden's numbers temporarily.
Will it jumpstart the economy? Will there be a way to keep these gains? Or essentially, have we traded a short-term construction boom with long-term tax revenue?
Capelli and Danley agree that the job gains are excellent news for the eternally down-on-its-luck city. But Capelli is optimistic those gains will continue long after the construction workers are gone.
I think there's a rosy picture ahead for the Camden metropolitan area.
The Bureau of Labor Statistics data isn't broken down on a town or city basis, so it's not clear exactly how much of the growth is happening in Camden City versus the surrounding towns. From the New Jersey desk, I'm Joe Hernandez, WHYY News.
As Camden sees a boost in jobs, some once beleaguered schools in Philadelphia are seeing their fortunes turn. A combination of gentrification and immigration has made half-empty buildings now overflowing. But that brings new challenges, as WHYY's Avi Wolfman-Arad explains.
On a recent Friday, Principal Lisa Kaplan takes me on two tours.
So when I got here, it was pretty horrible.
The first tour is virtual. It lives in a PowerPoint presentation on Kaplan's computer, and it shows a school in disarray. There's a drab-looking gym with moldy curtains, a cracked slab of concrete masquerading as a playground.
Water leaks throughout. Dull and dismal, lights out.
This is what Andrew Jackson School near Washington Avenue in South Philadelphia looked like just 7 short years ago when Kaplan arrived as principal.
It was sort of like a dumping ground kind of school, and when you would say the word Jackson, people go, oh, Jackson. Oh, I never sent my kid.
Next, Kaplan tours me around present-day Jackson. Changes are startling, starting with a gym that's been overhauled and fitted with soundproofing panels.
This was done by the Friends of Jackson group 2 years ago. This is our new playground.
So many of the stops on Kaplan's tour start with the word new. The playground, the greenhouse, the gym. Much of it was built thanks to donations from local businesses and parents. Signs of the new wealth that has flooded this neighborhood, especially the Bella Vista area, over the past decade. And Jackson itself is booming. Since Kaplan took over, the school's population has nearly doubled. Hence, this tour has a second theme, overcrowding.
You know, all the classrooms are full. This is the special ed room. I have three teachers sharing this space.
There have long been a handful of desirable public elementary schools in Philly, but they've often been in the ritziest parts of Center City. Jackson, by contrast, is a mile and a half south of City Hall, and there are schools even further south threatening to run out of room.
I think it's really about people wanting to stay in the city, number one, and trying to figure out a way to make that feasible.
Melissa Wild and Steve Vaselli are both sociologists. They moved to South Philly in 2006 before they had kids. And instead of scooting to the suburbs when their oldest turned five, they opted instead for Jackson after hearing good things from other middle-class neighbors.
There was a buzz that it was a place you could maybe consider. But in terms of neighborhood middle-class people, there weren't that many at the time.
That has started to change. Over the last 7 years, the number of white students at Jackson has more than tripled. Wild, Vaselli, and other mostly white middle-class parents also helped create a fundraising arm for the school called Friends of Jackson.
Friends of Jackson started right there in our living room over a tray of eggplant.
Friends of Jackson has pumped tens of thousands of dollars into the school. But the school's growth hasn't simply been a byproduct of gentrification. New immigrant families are also growing at Jackson. On a recent Wednesday, I meet Sergio Ruiz, a Jackson dad and chef at a local Mexican restaurant.
Every time when I pick up my song, everybody like feel happy, feel comfortable, you know.
Ruiz immigrated from the town of Puebla, near Mexico City. He likes Jackson in part because of its growing Latino population.
Especially that one is one of the first is on South Philly. They have a lot of Latin people. That one is the best. I mean, the best place don't have too many more discrimination. You know?
The neighborhood around Jackson is a microcosm of the new Philadelphia. A recent influx of immigrants and white-collar professionals has reversed 50 years of population loss in the city. Meanwhile, the renaissance in South Philly's public schools has helped the district tread water after years of enrollment decline. The result at Jackson is a thriving school with textbook diversity. Now the question is how to keep the momentum.
Thank you so much for braving the weather and coming out here this evening.
On a rain-drenched Friday in late March, nearly 100 community members pack into a rec center in South Philly for a meeting on overcrowding at Jackson. As the sounds of a nearby Mexican dance class bleed through the concrete walls, parent Marina D'Angelo lays out the scenario.
It's obvious the school is growing, and so people are asking, what's going to happen when we start to burst at the seams?
The district could add trailers or lease extra space. It could reduce the number of grades at Jackson, which is now a K-8 school. It could create a lottery system for getting into kindergarten, or it could redraw the feeder pattern so that Jackson takes in fewer kids. Now, none of these things has happened yet. In the short term, the district has decided to close Jackson off to transfer students, and that has some parents, including Melissa Wild, upset.
The reality of the situation is our catchment is wealthier and whiter than the school is still today. The school's changing to reflect the catchment.
A catchment, by the way, is what you call the neighborhood designated to send kids to a given public school.
So I think, obviously, if people care about diversity, they have to make the neighborhood public school available to people outside of the catchment.
Wild worries that as South Philly gentrifies, the only way to maintain Jackson's diversity will be to allow transfer students from outside the neighborhood. Right now, nearly 40% of Jackson students transfer in.
So closing off voluntary transfers is not a solution. It's obviously necessary if we're beyond capacity. So again, I get back to the fact that we don't have room in terms of what people value about the school to keep K-8 in that school.
In essence, the question is how you manage growth. It's not a familiar question for the School District of Philadelphia, but it's an increasingly important one. I'm Avi Wolf-Manarit, WHYY News.
A group of pharmacy school students in Philadelphia is working to help prevent opioid deaths in Philadelphia. They're visiting drugstores and overdose hotspots to raise awareness about naloxone, the life-saving drug that can help revive those who OD. Joel Wolfram reports from WHYY's Behavioral Health Desk.
The second stop of the day for three students from the Philadelphia College of Pharmacy is a windowless brick storefront in Fairhill.
Good morning.
Cambria Pharmacy is just blocks from Philadelphia's most notorious heroin encampment, but it doesn't stock naloxone. A standing order from the state physician general in 2015 made it legal for pharmacies to provide naloxone to anyone who walks in asking for it. But the pharmacist here, David Ostro, tells the volunteers he isn't clear on how it works.
So who do you put in as a physician on a standing order?
So the physician is the physician general of Pennsylvania, which is Dr. Rachel Levine.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
And then the directions would just be like ordered through standing order, use as directed, and then you dispense it.
Okay.
A survey done last year in city neighborhoods that suffer the most overdoses found that fewer than one in eight pharmacies had naloxone in their stores. Many pharmacists didn't know about the standing order or didn't understand what it meant. Now, the students are going out into those neighborhoods to boost awareness about the life-saving drug. More than 50 of them have signed up, along with faculty members and volunteers from Prevention Point Philadelphia. Prevention Point's Silvana Matsella is helping coordinate.
We're really going to let the pharmacy students do most of the talking because I really believe that pharmacists will listen to future pharmacists.
At Cambria Pharmacy, the students answered questions on how to bill insurance for the drug and which formulations are best. Ostro said he hadn't received that kind of education on naloxone, which also goes by the brand name Narcan.
And I probably will, now that you've been here, will be ordering this in Narcan in for tomorrow.
Awesome.
Thank you so much.
It was exactly what the students were hoping to hear. For WHYY News, I'm Joel Wolfram.
It's said that the soul is unknowable. But if poetry is the language of the soul, then Madalena Richardson's soul speaks loudly and clearly. The 17-year-old junior at Masterman High in Philadelphia will compete starting tomorrow in Poetry Out Loud, the national championship for poetry recitation. Richardson is the Pennsylvania champion, having beaten out around 300,000 other contestants across the country. I spoke with her last week, and she started off with one of the poems she's chosen to recite for the tournament.
Caged Bird by Maya Angelou. A free bird leaps on the back of the wind and floats downstream till the current ends, and dips his wings in the orange sun rays and dares to claim the sky. But a bird that stalks down his narrow cage can seldom see through his bars of rage. His wings are clipped and his feet are tied, so he opens his throat to sing. The caged bird sings with a fearful trill of things unknown but longed for still. And his tune is heard on the distant hill, for the caged bird sings of freedom. The free bird thinks of another breeze, and the trade winds soft through the sighing trees, and the fat worms waiting on a dawn bright lawn, and he names the sky his own. But a caged bird stands on the grave of dreams. His shadow shouts on a nightmare scream. His wings are clipped and his feet are tied, so he opens his throat to sing. The caged bird sings with a fearful trill of things unknown but longed for still. And his tune is heard on the distant hill, for the caged bird sings of freedom.
What a beautiful recitation. In preparation for this and for the competition, did you listen to Maya Angelou's recitation of that poem?
I looked for it. I did not find her doing it. I found lots of other people reciting it, but not her. So
I have to keep asking, have you ever heard Maya Angelou
recite poetry and going back? Because it seemed to me, if I close my eyes, you were summoning aspects of her, what I would imagine her delivery to be.
Yeah,
it's truly extraordinary.
I remember watching a Tyler Perry movie, and she performed one of her poems. I'm not sure what it was. It was just a segment, like, in the background, kind of. So I got a sense of what her voice might sound like. So I kind of incorporated a little bit into what I do for her poem.
Yeah. Did you come to this through a love of performance or poetry or reading or, in this case, Maya Angelou? How did you get to even the starting line in terms of your interests?
Well, I've always loved to act. I've done it since I was little. I love performing. And a few years ago, I realized I really love to write stories and poems and stuff. And I love listening to people recite their own poetry, but I didn't know there was any way to incorporate the two in terms of performing and poetry, let alone reciting other people's poetry. So I find it's a lot more challenging to perform someone else's poem rather than your own, because there's always a fear of people not liking your own work. So it's easier to try and recite other people's, but then it's also hard because you're not sure what they want you to incorporate and how they want it to come across.
Explain more what resonated with you with Caged Bird, Maya Angelou.
Well, my interpretation of it was, at first it was very literal in a sense, where there is a free bird and a caged bird, and one wants to be free but can't and is suffering because of that. But then if you interpret it in today's society, it can be taken on many viewpoints of multiple oppressed groups of people being a caged bird and not being able to speak freely or be able to do what they want freely or wear what they want or act as they want freely, while there are other groups that might have certain privileges that the oppressed people don't and are able to be the free bird.
Well, I in turn wish for you, if it pleases you, that someday you write a poem that in subsequent generations will be recited and interpreted by others as well. Thanks for joining us on Newsworks Tonight.
Thank you for having me.
Madalena Richardson, a student at Masterman School in Philadelphia, proceeding this Tuesday to the national competition. You can hear much more of our conversation at newsworks.org. A newly detected dwarf planet is the latest addition to the inventory of objects in our solar system. Let's train our telescopes with Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute, though, Derek, we can't do that training here in the Philadelphia region.
This is an object that was detected in a very distant portion of our solar system by the 4-meter Blanco telescope at Cerro Tololo in Chile. From that location, plenty of dark skies, this object was swept up as part of what's called the Dark Energy Survey. This survey of about 12% of the sky was actually looking for dark energy sources. In 15,000 images, over a million different objects were identified, and after some sorting, this object, which seemed to be moving very slowly through the field of view, was detected.
Interesting, because clearly this is not the dark energy that was the intent of this project.
No. It's as if a broad net was thrown out into the ocean and you're really looking for cod or something and you end up with, you know, a squid or a turtle or something like that in the net. And so in this particular instance, the telescope was able to detect that it was there, but we didn't really know very much about it. So further investigation was required with a different instrument. All we could tell about the object so far is a little bit about its distance and its orbit, but a much bigger instrument was used, the Atacama Large Millimeter Submillimeter Radio Array, which is also in Chile in the Atacama Desert, very, very high up at 16,500 feet. And what was determined is that this object is 635 kilometers in size, so it's about two-thirds the size of one of the largest objects in our solar system, Ceres, the dwarf planet Ceres. We've also been able to determine that this object is spherical in shape. Its mass tells us that it's probably spherical in shape, and it's very dark. It's only reflecting about 13% of the light that it gets from the sun. So we've been able to identify its orbit as enormous. This object will take 1,100 years to orbit our sun.
So the light from our sun reaches us in a matter of, what, 8 or 9 minutes?
Yes.
How long does that same sunlight take to get to Didi?
13 hours. 13 hours is the light time it takes for light to get from this part of the solar system all the way out there. But as you can imagine, at that distance, not only is it very dark, but it's also very cold. It's only about 30 degrees above absolute zero.
An object that far out, is it known whether it is an indigenous part of our solar system, or was it captured from somewhere outside?
Yeah, that's a really great question, because one of the things that we're learning is that the region of our solar system out beyond Neptune turns out to be rich with objects orbiting the sun that could easily be defined as planets. You know, they're big enough, massive enough to have a spherical shape. They're in orbit around the sun. They may have cleared their orbits of additional detritus left over from their beginning. And so that makes the solar system much more complex than we thought it was.
Just step out of doors. What's available to be seen in the night sky this week?
Great stuff in the evening sky. Mars is still hanging over on the western side of the sky. It seems like it's been there forever now, but it's just because of the different orbital positions of Earth and Mars in relation to the sun that has given us this very long viewing window from last fall all the way through to later this spring. But if we just hang around until the sky gets dark, now the giant gas planet Jupiter is high up in the eastern sky. Right after sunset, you can't miss it, and is with us all night long. For those that are up early in the morning, you have a very special treat, because at 5:30 in the morning, we have both Jupiter and Saturn. Jupiter far over on the western side of the sky, about to set just before sunrise, and Saturn well up in the south at 5:30 a.m.
Thanks, Derek.
My pleasure, Dave.
Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. He joins us each week at this time on Newsworks Tonight. That's all for tonight's show. Newsworks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, Ty Johnson, and Brett Rader. Find us on iTunes or listen back at newsworks.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for Newsworks Tonight.